destruction, by the way, most of the scientists who noticed this destructive power in America were scientists from the Jewish background. Scientists like Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. These scientists had migrated from Eastern Europe. They decided to inform the American authorities about the heinous power after feeling the danger that the German Nazis were about to discover the secret of the reverse movement of creation. They wrote to Albert Einstein and asked him to write a letter to the President of the United States. In that letter, he mentioned the destructive power of a newly discovered energy and informed that the Nazis were making a devastating bomb based on this energy. This letter attracted the attention of then-President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt. At that time, only 2 months had passed since the start of World War II, and the United States had still remained neutral. On October 21, 1939, a meeting of the Special Committee to investigate this issue was held with the presence of Jewish scholars, Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. The result of this meeting was that uranium can be the source of production of bombs that were more destructive than any other material ever experienced in the world. They proposed a budget of $167,000 for uranium research. They mainly studied uranium-235 isotope and a new substance called plutonium. The Americans chose a Jewish physicist from the University of California to lead the bomb production project, J. Robert Oppenheimer. He held various meetings in U.S. universities with many physicists to investigate possibilities and solutions. The American government informed the research group that it would provide them with any kind of financial, human, and logistical assistance. Oppenheimer was a Jew, but he was very interested in Indian mythology. One of the myths was Mahabharata, the national epic of Indians. A part of this epic was called Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu, the Hindu god, wore war clothes and became the destroyer of the worlds. J. Robert Oppenheimer was designing the most destructive weapon in history, and he saw this myth as his source of inspiration. The destroyer of worlds was an inverse reflection of the Jewish creation myth, the return of matter to energy, and the subsequent destruction of the world. On December 18, 1941, Japanese fighter jets attack Pearl Harbor. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Following the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, the United States declared war on Japan and Germany. U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called his country arsenal of democracy and aroused the emotions of members of Congress with a sensational speech.
Since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Franklin D. Roosevelt knew that war was America's first priority from then on. The Japanese were fierce warriors, so the Manhattan Project had already become important for the U.S. At the same time, hatred against Japanese and Germans was being propagated all over America. The U.S. propaganda machine also used Walt Disney animation. The U.S. had entered into chaos. the intense propaganda of the American government for enlistment began. American soldiers went to war in the Pacific Ocean. Some soldiers went to Europe. Humanity experienced the most terrible war until that time, a kind of war that was a direct product of modern times. The Japanese also had a myth similar to the Jews for the creation of the world. In the oldest Japanese legends, the world before creation was nothing but formless matter. Something called chaos. The silence reigned in the time of turmoil and disorder. Suddenly, the sound rose and particles began to move. The movement of particles created light. Thus, light was placed at the highest place in the world, and below it were particles that first created clouds and then heaven. The Japanese concept of light and then cloud had a strange similarity with the Jewish concept of light and then water. The movement of particles in Japanese mythology led to the creation of light energy. The cloud was formed, and under that was heaven. In the modern era, this myth took on a frightening and twisted description. Far from the two fronts of Europe and the Pacific Ocean, the nuclear scientists of America, England, and Canada continued their research in silence. Oak Ridge in Tennessee was a first proposed area for research. The government forcibly seized 56,000 acres of land in this area worth $3.5 million to carry out its research. Later, another 3,000 acres were added to the area. 1,000 families had lost their land under the influence of the government's behavior. Complaints and legal procedures of these citizens against the government did not reach any conclusion, though. Finally, people complained to their Congress representatives, but the Congress investigation could not challenge the government's decision. Some of these families had lived in these properties for generations, but they had to vacate their land within 2 weeks, according to the military order. The Army did not pay the families more than $47 per acre. The villagers had no choice but to sell their land. Oak Ridge nuclear research was mostly theoretical from then on. It seemed the Jewish immigration scientists and Americans still had a long way to go to the practical stage of nuclear fission. But finally, in 1943, the research entered the phase of practical experiments. For several months, the Army and scientists were looking for a suitable place to carry out the experiments. J. Robert Oppenheimer owned a large land in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He suggested conducting the experiments in that area. Jemez Springs in New Mexico was another alternative. But this area was surrounded by Rocky Mountains. Oppenheimer did not like the area and said that in order for the employees not to be afraid, it was better to find a wide and flat area. Finally, Los Alamos was chosen. Oppenheimer went to Los Alamos and was impressed by the beauty of nature. Since then, the beautiful area was a secret laboratory of American nuclear bombs. With the continuous activity of uranium enrichment centers, the United States was finally able to obtain 50 kilograms of uranium-235 with a purity of 89% by July 1945. Nuclear scientists entered a new stage, designing the bomb. At the same time, the war continued. Little by little, the Allies' success became evident. The Americans, with the support of the British, entered the mainland of Europe in the invasion of Normandy and the north of France. On August 25, 1944, Paris was liberated. In Europe, the war was in the favor of the Allies. In Asia, Japan surrounded the Assam region of India, but finally retreated. Pacific, America was able to defeat the Japanese forces in the Palau Islands. The naval battles between America and Japan in the Pacific Ocean ended one after another in favor of the Americans. Far from these battles, in the seemingly calm but quiet deserts of Los Alamos, nuclear scientists had come to the conclusion that they had to conduct an experiment and detonate the first bomb for test. Before carrying out that experiment, Germany was captured in April 1945. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. Managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics. The third god was a creator god, or Brahma, similar to Jewish creation myths. But in front of him were gods with destructive forces. Scientists bet on the Trinity test. Some predicted that the bomb would not work. Some predicted its strength up to 45 tons of TNT. Another Jewish physicist, Isidor Isaac Rabi, predicted that the bomb would have the power of 18,000 tons of TNT. He was almost right. Isidor Isaac Rabi won that bet.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The first atomic bomb was tested at 5:29 and 45 seconds a.m. Mountain War Time on July 16, 1945. The explosion almost equaled 20,000 tons of TNT. A pit with a diameter of 340 meters and a depth of 3 meters was made at the place of the explosion. Observers who were at least 16 kilometers away from the epicenter reported the high heat during the blast. The surrounding mountains seemed brighter than usual for a few seconds. The sky looked purple, which gradually changed to green and finally turned white. 40 seconds after the explosion, they suddenly heard its sound. The blast waves shook up to a radius of 160 kilometers. Kenneth Bainbridge, one of the test directors, remarked to J. Robert Oppenheimer immediately after the test, "Now, we are all sons of bitches." Oppenheimer later said that at the moment of seeing the first nuclear explosion, he was thinking of a passage from the mystical book of Hindu religion. In a part of the book, the Hindu god says, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." At that time, Harry Truman had become president of the United States and was at Potsdam Conference. Potsdam was located in occupied Germany. Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and Harry S. Truman attended the conference. The conference was held to clarify the situation of post-war Europe and defeated Germany.
Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender. I want the entire world to know that this direction must and will remain unchanged and unhampered.
On the other hand, participants in the conference were waiting for the outcome of the war in the Pacific Ocean and Asia, Japan. Harry S. Truman received a coded telegram at Potsdam at 7:30 p.m. on July 16th. Operated on this morning, diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceed expectations. Harry S. Truman informed Stalin that America had achieved a new and powerful weapon. On July 26, 1945, the Allies issued and announced an ultimatum which outlined the terms of surrender for the Empire of Japan. The ultimatum stated that if Japan did not surrender, it would face prompt and utter destruction, but this statement did not talk about the new bomb.
Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine. If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany. Our blows will destroy their whole modern industrial plant and organization, which they have built up during the past century and which they are now devoting to a hopeless cause. We have no desire or intention to destroy or enslave the Japanese people. But only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance.
In the first days of August 1945, the United States announced the names of several cities as targets of airstrikes by spreading leaflets over Japanese cities. The Japanese people thought that they were just bombings of conventional weapons, and news of the invention of the nuclear bomb had not yet spread. The United States did not mention Hiroshima among the cities it warned, while Hiroshima was the first target of the Americans for nuclear bombing. The Americans chose the bomb, the little boy, for Hiroshima.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is
Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned.
If Allah wants to establish friendship between himself and his servants, he sometimes does it through making obstacles on the ways of his servants. This way, the people find their solution only in Allah. Now, every person has problems in this world, and the door of mercy of Allah is open to all. If the door of mercy was closed, there was also no obstacle for people. These hardships are the ways to the affection and love of Allah.
Saadi ham hamin mige farashu bejum chobi.
As Sa'di, the famous Persian poet, states, the door of mercy and peace is open, so hurry up, and know that repentance for your bad deeds has a specific time. This means that the door of mercy of Allah is always open, and we must benefit from it. Also, we must not postpone our regret for our bad deeds to the last moments. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime should be included in the annual list of shame for its violations against Palestinian children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, more than half of the population living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are below 18. In fact, one can confidently say that half of the people of the occupied West Bank and besieged Gaza Strip are children. Anyone who wages a war against these two territories through house demolition, arrest without trial, shoot-to-kill policy, and humiliation is waging war against children. At times, whole military brigades of the Zionist regime army, accompanied by elite units, border police, and police, chase a boy and, in most cases, kill him or, at best, arrest him. If there is anything that changed in the last few years in what finally the United Nations was willing to call the colonization of Palestine, it is the intensification of the Zionist regime shoot-to-kill policy. And although so many of Palestinians understand that the new Israeli regime cabinet will not change the policies the previous cabinets pursued, one can expect further brutalization in the war against the people of Palestine. The news has reached us of murder by the Zionist regime troops of Fula Ramsey Abdul Aziz al-Musalama. She was on her way to celebrating her 16th birthday. She was with others in a car near Beitunia when the Zionist regime troops, without any reason, opened fire on the car and killed her. Needless to say, the Zionist newspaper reporting the incident blamed the driver and did not even bother to mention her name. The killing of children is not a new aspect of Israeli policies toward the Palestinians. By April 1948, the Zionist regime military leadership of forces began to strategize more clearly its policy towards any population that would be left in the villages they occupied during the 1948 ethnic cleansing. One of its clear guidelines was to either kill or send to a prison camp, at the discretion of the commander on the spot, men at a fighting age. The command clearly defines what is meant by men, anyone above the age of 10. Very much like any destructive Israeli regime policy since the massive expulsion and killings of 1948, a new method of incremental piecemeal action and policy became the norm. It is a very deceptive policy, as whomever you want to alert is faced with a killing of one or two persons every now and then, and the dots are not easily connected to produce a damning indictment. This was true in the early 1950s, but of course, since then, the numbers are massive and this incremental killing is far more visible. In November 1950, the Zionist regime army shot dead three children ages 8, 10, and 12 from the village of Yalo, while in 1952, the Israeli commando murdered four children, ranging from ages 6 to 14, in Beit Jala. A year later, among the five shepherds the Zionist regime killed in February 1953, one was 13-year-old boy from Alberg. The incremental infanticide at times is replaced by a more intensive killing of children. During the First Intifada, according to the Association of Israeli and Palestinian Physicians for Human Rights, every 2 weeks, a child under 6 was shot in the head by the Zionist regime army. During the Second Intifada, 600 Palestinian children were killed. Among them are the 12-year-old Mohammad Ad-Dore, the 14-year-old Faris Odeh, an 11-year-old Khaled al-Mughrabi. 5,000 children were wounded. In 2007, the Israeli regime air force killed 8 children of the Shahada family in Gaza. In the first wave of the attack on Gaza in 2008, more than 300 children died, and another 30 in 2012. At the highest death recorded in 2014, with more than 550 children. Put differently, since 2,250 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli regime army and security forces. This is equivalent to the killing of nearly 45,000 children in Britain by military or police force since 2000. Why is it so important to record these grim and horrifying data and define clearly its legal and moral significance? For a few reasons. First, the fact that only here, in an alternative media outlet, you will be aware of these atrocities is an indication of the hypocrisy of the Western media and political elite when it comes to Palestine, compared to the compassion shown toward children in Ukraine. Secondly, these figures accentuate the existential threat Zionism still poses to the Palestinian people and their future. It is not only land that the fabricated regime of Israel covets, it is intent on continuing the destruction of the people themselves. But most important than all is the infuriating exemption of Palestine from the international discussion of the mass killing in general and that of children in particular. Take, for example, the international definition of mass killing. It is defined as the deliberate actions of armed groups, including but not limited to state security forces that result in the death of at least 1,000 non-combatant civilians targeted as part of a specific group over a period of one or less. In the first and second intifada in 2009 and 2014, the number of Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime exceeded by far 1,000. Nowhere in the UN or another human rights organization recording mass killings worldwide do the Palestinians appear as a case study. The game is not of numbers, of course, but much more about the ideology that facilitates such mass killing, a kind of inhumanity, only possible if the humans you target are dehumanized, an ideology that leads in many cases to genocidal policies. The definition of genocide, according to Article 2 of the UN Charter on Genocide, includes mass killing, bodily and mental harm, and physical desertion as indicators of such policies. The report of the Special Representative of the Secretary General in October 2009 and updated in November 2013 lists 6 grave violations of international human rights law regarding children's rights in armed conflict. There is no armed conflict in Palestine, and yet 3 of these grave violations occur daily in the colonized West Bank and occasionally in massive numbers in besieged Gaza Strip. Killing and maiming of children, attacks against schools and hospitals, and denial of humanitarian access. Some of the Israeli regime policies enacted during the siege on Gaza in terms of denial of food, energy, and above all medical help create a criterion by itself that should have been added to this document. In August this year, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet expressed alarm at the high number of Palestinians, including children, killed and injured in the occupied Palestinian territory since the beginning of 2022. She was referring to the killing of 37 children from the beginning of the year until that August, and was particularly horrified by the killing of 19 children in 1 week, she stated. Inflicting hurt on any child during the course of conflict is deeply disturbing, and the killing and maiming of so many children this year is unconscionable. Meanwhile, Press TV reported the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the United Nations to include Israel in its annual list of shame for its violations against Palestinian children. In a statement on the occasion of the World Children's Day recently, Hamas urged the world body to pressure the Tel Aviv regime for the immediate release of all Palestinian children being held behind Israeli regime bars. The resistance movement also called on international human rights groups to protect the Palestinian children against the Zionist regime. The UN marks the World Children's Day, while the suffering of the Palestinian children who are exposed to the most heinous forms of crime by Israeli war machine and a systematic racist policy is ongoing, the statement read. Elsewhere in the statement, it said about 3 dozen Palestinian children had been killed by Israeli regime forces during the current year, and 160 others suffer from various forms of psychological and physical torture in Israeli regime prisons. The Palestinian Prisoners Society, PPS, recently said Israeli military forces had arrested more than 750 Palestinian children during arrest campaigns across the occupied West Bank and East al-Quds since the beginning of the current year. The PPS in November 2020 highlighted rights violations committed by Israeli regime forces against minor Palestinian prisoners. The youth are often abducted from homes in the middle of the night, detained for hours without food or drink, and verbally abused. Israeli regime prison authorities also forced the children into confession by threatening to torture them. Interrogations are done without the presence of a parent or a lawyer. In May 2020, a study found that the Zionist regime had arrested up to 16,500 Palestinian children since the outbreak of the Second Intifada in late 2000. The Detainees Affairs Commission of the Palestine Liberation Organization also revealed recently that the Israeli regime had detained over 50,000 Palestinian children since the occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds in 1967.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the laws or religious laws related to business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question, since we are talking about the business-related Islamic laws. I wanted to ask you if you could shed some light on some of the, let's say, receiving wages of a wajib act, you know, wajib and mustahab act. And what is the ruling and what is the Islamic law on receiving wages for work that somebody is not obligated to do? In other words, it's recommended, right?
Yes.
Such as reciting, for example, eulogies, all
right? Right.
On the occasions of the martyrdom of the infallible imams and saints, and sometimes recite the Holy Quran, for example, over the graves.
Graves.
And or supplications, for example, if you're asked to do so, right? And also making istikhara and stuff like that. Would you please tell us?
Well, this is a very important question because a lot of people wonder as to whether receiving wages for a wajib act or a mustahab act is basically permissible or not. When it comes to wajib acts, of course, we have a lot of wajib acts like prayer, fasting, and things like that. For example, I give the example of a prayer leader who goes to a mosque and offer and leads a congregational prayer. Can he recite? Can he receive money for the prayer he offers or the prayer he leads? Of course not. It is absolutely forbidden for a prayer leader to receive wages for the prayer which he himself is obligated to perform,
mm-hmm.
because it is every individual's obligation to perform prayers, and now some people stand behind him. He shouldn't receive any wages for the acts which are wajib. Now the wajib acts are sometimes, you know, collective duties, like for example bathing or washing the body of a deceased individual. It is a collective duty. Of course, even for a collective duty, because it's the duty of every Muslim individual, basically to give ghusl to a dead body and to perform the duty So no one can receive wages for the duty he is supposed to perform, mm-hmm. and he is supposed to do. So whether the duty is collective or individual, like prayer, one cannot receive any wages for the wajib act. This is a general answer, and it applies to all wajib acts. Okay. Mm-hmm. As for the mustahab acts, of course, again, I should say that there are numerous mustahab acts which people do on daily basis. Like the example you gave, like reciting supplications or maybe reciting, let's say, salawat or making istikhara. And there are other acts which mm-hmm. a person may or may not do, okay,
right.
because it's not wajib. So if a person decides or chooses to receive wages for that act, there's no objection to him. It is permissible. Like, for example, we see in our day-to-day life, there are people who recite, the Holy Quran
mm-hmm.
On behalf of a deceased person or on behalf of another individual. And he accepts wages for the recitation, or he recites salawat, and then he receives wages for that act. So the examples, there are too many examples, but this is obviously the answer. The answer is that it is basically permissible to receive wages for mustahab acts.
What about the eulogies? Because eulogies is one of those recommended acts, right?
Yes, of course.
Especially for the commemoration of the martyrdom of some of the infallibles, right?
You are right.
And should it be certain when, for example, the person, the eulogizer, the eulogist, should it make his amount or his wage certain, or he should leave it open-ended?
You're right. And this is a question raised by many people,
right?
Especially when they come to know that many of the eulogists or eulogists receive a huge amount of money from their audience,
right?
And this raises the question as to why they should receive this money okay, if they receive a small amount of money, there is no objection to them, okay? Because they come and go, they prepare themselves.
Right.
But when the amount is so huge and so mm-hmm. exorbitant,
yes,
then that actually raises some eyebrows. Many people get angry as to why these people receive a lot of...
Make money out of religion.
Yeah, out of religion. That's the point. Of course, you know, the people can choose not to give money.
Right.
And they can invite people who are, you know...
Like they do it, they practice it free of charge.
Yeah, free of charge, yes. And it's not necessary to invite some famous or very well-known eulogists who might
ask for too
demand
much.
For a huge amount of money. Of course, it's not morally good to receive such wages, but okay, if people choose to give, okay, the people themselves sometimes,
right.
It's the people, not the eulogist who mm-hmm. wants money. So if there are people who want to give money to the eulogist and he receives it, and there's mutual consent on both sides, there is no objection to that individual receiving money from the people.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program. Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about business-related religious laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Tawheed, before the break, I asked you some questions about the wages received on behalf of or in return for, actually, the wajib or mustahab acts, right?
Yes.
And now, let me ask you this question. Is it permissible to, give the wage or any amount to the recital of the Quran, all right?
Yeah.
As a recompense. To complete, for example, the Holy Quran for one's dead, like those people who mourn over those people, right?
Yes.
So is it for the, in fact, those people who are left behind, is it permissible for the reader of the Quran also to put a condition? Sometimes they
yes.
Give stipulations,
yeah.
like notes, in addition to their work, right?
Yeah.
So if they put the condition for the complete recitation of the Quran, so is it permissible for them to do so?
Mm. Well, it is, because the act is mustahab, that it is permissible for the person who recites the Quran to stipulate that he will recite the entire Quran from the beginning till the end,
mm-hmm.
and will receive a certain amount of money specified by him, and there's no objection to him. So the other party, of the, or the other party to the contract, can choose not to give or not to choose him as the reciter of the Holy Quran. He can look for another person. So if he accepts and he agrees to pay them the money, he should pay it. Okay, he should pay the amount of money. And there's one point I would like to mention when it comes to wajib acts like prayer, okay? Some people, this is the point, if I can just
right.
add it, because that may leave some kind of doubt about
mm-hmm.
in the minds of some of the listeners as to why some of the prayer leaders receive money when they shouldn't, okay? And is this the money received by those prayer leaders halal or haram? Of
mm-hmm.
course, I should say that, okay, it is permissible for a prayer leader to receive money for not prayer, not for the prayer, but for other acts. Like, for example, he has to walk a long way from his home to the mosque or to the place where the prayer congregational prayer is held. So he has to prepare himself. He has to, let's say, take a taxi, or he has to take the bus or something in order to come to the mosque. And this will take him, cost him a lot. Sometimes it
mm-hmm.
will cost him. So for that individual, he can receive the money with the intention or for that reason,
mm-hmm.
because he comes, he has to be there on
yes.
time. So there's no objection to him receiving money for these purposes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Shafi. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.